suggests there are an infinite number of divergent parallel universes. Every moment of your life you enter is a new universe, with every decision you make. And traditionally, it was thought that there would be no communication or transference between those worlds, even though they happen in the same space, even though they happen literally millimeters away from us. But what about us? We're doing that. Exactly. I'm here, but I also know I am not here. I am also lying in a hospital in Paris, having an aneurysm. And I'm also skydiving in Arizona, and traveling around southern India, and tasting wine in Lyon, and lying on a yacht off the Côte d'Azur. I knew it. Vraiment? He was, she decided, quite beautiful. You seem more suited to stroll in the Croisette in Cannes than an Arctic adventure. He widened his right hand like a starfish. 5 days. 5 days I have been in this life. That is my record. Maybe this is the life for me. Interesting. You're going to have a very cold life. And who knows? Maybe you are too. I mean, if the bear didn't take you back to your library, maybe nothing will. He started to fill the kettle. Science tells us that the gray zone between life and death is a mysterious place. There is a singular point at which we are not one thing or another, or rather we are both, alive and dead. And in that moment between the two binaries, sometimes, just sometimes, we turn ourselves into a Schrödinger's cat, who may not only be alive or dead, but maybe every quantum possibility that exists in line with the universal wave function, including the possibility where we are chatting in a communal kitchen in Longyearbyen at 1 in the morning. Nora was taking all this in. She thought of vaults, still and lifeless under the bed and lying by the side of the road. But sometimes, the cat is just dead and dead. Sorry? Nothing. It's just, my cat died, and I tried another life, and even in that one he was still dead. And that's sad. I had a similar situation with the Labrador. But the point is, there are others like us. I have lived so many lives. I have come across a few of them. Sometimes just to say your own truth out loud is enough to find others like you. It's crazy to think that there are other people who could be, what did you call us? Sliders. Yeah, that. Well, it's possible, of course, but I think we're rare. One thing I've noticed is that other people I've met, the dozen or so, have all been around our age, all 30s or 40s or 50s. One was 29 or fay. All have had a deep desire to have done things differently. They had regrets. Some contemplated that they may be better off dead, but also had a desire to live as another version of themselves. Schrödinger's life, both dead and alive in your own mind. Exactement. And whatever those regrets did to our brain, whatever, how would you say, neurochemical event happened, that confused yearning for death and life was somehow just enough to send us into this state of total in-between. The kettle was getting noisier, the water starting to bubble like Nora's thoughts. Why is it always just one person that we see? In the place, the library, whatever. Hugo shrugged. If I was religious, I'd say it was God. And as God is probably someone we can't see or comprehend, then he, or she, or whichever pronoun God is, becomes an image of someone good we have known in our lives. And if I wasn't religious, which I'm not, I would think that the human brain can't handle the complexity of an open quantum wave function, and so it organizes or translates this complexity into something it understands. A librarian in a library, a friendly uncle in a video store, etc. Nora had read about multiverses and knew a bit about Gestalt psychology, about how human brains take complex information about the world and simplify it, so that when a human looks at a tree, it translates the intricately complex mass of leaves and branches into this thing called tree. To be a human was to continually dumb the world down into an understandable story that keeps things simple. She knew that everything humans see is a simplification. A human sees the world in three dimensions. That is a simplification. Humans are fundamentally limited, generalizing creatures living on autopilot, who straighten out curved streets in their minds, which explains why they get lost all the time. "It's like how humans never see the second hand of a clock mid-tick," said Nora. "What?" She saw that Hugo's watch was of the analog variety. "Try it. You just can't. Minds can't see what they can't handle." Hugo nodded as he observed his own watch. "So," Nora said, "whatever exists between universes is most likely not a library, but that is the easiest way for me to understand it. That would be my hypothesis. I see a simplified version of the truth. The librarian is just a kind of mental metaphor. The whole thing is." "Isn't it fascinating?" said Hugo. Nora sighed. "In the last life, I spoke to my dead dad." Hugo opened a jar of coffee and scooped out granules in two mugs. "And I didn't drink coffee. I drank peppermint tea." "That sounds terrible." "It was bearable." "Another thing that is strange," Hugo said. "At any point in this conversation, you or I could disappear." "Have you seen that happen?" Nora took the mug Hugo handed her. "Yeah. A few times. It's freaky. But no one else would notice. They'd become a bit vague with their memory for the last day, but you'd be surprised. If you went back to the library right now and I was still standing here talking to you in the kitchen, you would say something like, 'My mind's just gone blank. What were we talking about?' And then I realized what had happened, and I'd say we were talking about glaciers, and you'd bombard me with facts about them. And your brain would fill in the gaps and make up a narrative about what just happened." "Yeah. But what about the polar bear? What about the meal tonight? Would I, this other me, would she remember what I ate?" "Not necessarily, but I've seen it happen. It's amazing what the brain can fill in. And what it is fine with forgetting." "So what was I like? Yesterday, I mean." He locked eyes. They were pretty eyes. Nora momentarily felt pulled into his orbit like a satellite to Earth. "Exquisite. Charming. Intelligent. Beautiful. Much like now." She laughed it off. "Stop being so French." Awkward pause. "How many lives have you had?" she said eventually. "How many have you experienced?" "Too many. Nearly 300. 300? I have been so many things. On every continent on Earth, and yet I have never found the life for me. I'm resigned to being this way forever. There will never be a life that I truly want to live forever. I get too curious. I get too much of a yearning to live another way. And you don't need to make that face. It's not sad. I'm happily in limbo. But what if one day there is no video store?" Nora thought about Mrs. Elm panicking at the computer and the flickering lights in the library. "What if one day you disappear for good, before you have found a life to settle in?" He shrugged. "And then I will die. And it means I would have died anyway, in the life I lived before. I kind of like being a slider. I like imperfection. I like keeping death as an option. I like never having to settle. I think my situation is different. I think my death is more imminent. If I don't find a life to live in pretty soon, I think I'll be gone for good." She explained the problem she'd had last time with transferring back. Oh, yeah, well, that might be bad. But it might not be. You do realize there are infinite possibilities here. I mean, the multiverse isn't about just some universes. It's not about a handful of universes. It's not even about a lot of universes. It's not about a million or a billion or a trillion universes. It's about an infinite number of universes. Even with you in them. You could be you in any version of the world, however unlikely that world would be. You are only limited by your imagination. You can be very creative with the regrets you want to undo. I once undid a regret about not doing something I'd contemplated as a teenager, doing aerospace engineering and becoming an astronaut. And so in one life, I became an astronaut. I haven't been to space, but I became someone who had been there for a little while. The thing you have to remember is that this is an opportunity, and it is rare, and we can undo any mistake we make, live any life we want. Any life. Dream big. You can be anything you want to be. Because in one life, you are. She sipped her coffee. I understand. But you will never live if you are looking for the meaning of life, he said wisely. You're quoting Camus. And you got me. He was staring at her. Nora no longer minded his intensity, but was becoming a little concerned about her own. I was a philosophy student, she said, as blandly as she could manage, avoiding his eyes. He was close to her now. There was something equally annoying and attractive about Hugo. He exuded an arrogant amorality that made his face something to either slap or kiss, depending on the circumstances. In one life, we have known each other for years and are married, he said. In most lives, I don't know you at all, she countered, now staring straight at him. That's so sad. I don't think so. Really? Really, she smiled. We're special, Nora. We're chosen. No one understands us. No one understands anyone. We're not chosen. The only reason I am still in this life is because of you. She lunged forward and kissed him. If something is happening to me, I want to be there. It was a very pleasant sensation. Both the kiss and the knowledge she could be this forward. Being aware that everything that could possibly happen happened to her somewhere, in some life, kind of absolved her a little from decisions. That was just the reality of the universal wave function. Whatever was happening could, she reasoned, be put down to quantum physics. I don't share a room, he said. She stared at him fearlessly now, as if facing down a polar bear had given her a certain capacity for dominance she'd never been aware of. Well, Hugo, maybe you could break the habit. But the sex turned out to be a disappointment. A Camus quote came to her, right in the middle of it. I may not have been sure about what really did interest me, but I was absolutely sure about what didn't. It probably wasn't the best sign of how their nocturnal encounter was going, that she was thinking of existential philosophy, or that this quote in particular was the one that appeared in her mind. But hadn't Camus also said, if something is going to happen to me, I want to be there? Hugo, she concluded, was a strange person. For a man who had been so intimate and deep in his conversation, he was very detached from the moment. Maybe if you lived as many lives as he had, the only person you really had any kind of intimate relationship with was yourself. She felt like she might not have been there at all. And in a few moments, she wasn't. God and other librarians. Who are you? You know my name. I am Mrs. Elm. Louise Isabel Elm. Are you God? She smiled. I am who I am. And who is that? The librarian. But you aren't a real person. You're just a mechanism. Aren't we all? Not like that. You are the product of some strange interaction between my mind and the multiverse. Some simplification of the quantum wave function or whatever it is. Mrs. Elm looked perturbed by the suggestion. What is the matter? Nora thought of the polar bear as she stared down at the yellow-brown stone floor. I nearly died. And remember, if you die in a life, there is no way back here. That's not fair. The library has strict rules. Books are precious. You have to treat them carefully. But these are other lives. Other variants of me, not me, me. Yes, but while you are experiencing them, it is you who has to pay the consequences. Well, I think that stinks, to be perfectly honest. The librarian's smile curled at its edges, like a fallen leaf. Well, this is interesting. What is interesting? The fact that you have so thoroughly changed your attitude towards dying. What? You wanted to die? And now you don't. It dawned on Nora that Mrs. Elm might be close to having a point, although not quite the whole point. Well, I still think my actual life isn't worth living. In fact, this experience has just managed to confirm that. She shook her head. I don't think you think that. I do think that. That's why I said it. No. The Book of Regrets is getting lighter. There's a lot of white space in there now. It seems that you have spent all your life saying things that you aren't really thinking. This is one of your barriers. Barriers? Yes. You have a lot of them. They stop you from seeing the truth. About what? About yourself. And you really need to start trying to see the truth. Because this matters. I thought there were an infinite number of lives to choose from. You need to pick the life you'd be most happy inside, or soon there won't be a choice at all. I met someone who has been doing this for a long time, and he still hasn't found a life that he is satisfied with. Well, Hugo's is a privilege you might not have. Hugo, how do you... But then she remembered Mrs. Elm knew a lot more than she should. You need to choose carefully, continued the librarian. One day the library may not be here, and you'll be gone forever. How many lives do I have? This isn't a magic lamp, and I am no genie. There is no set number. It could be one. It could be 100. But you only have an infinite number of lives to choose from so long as the time in the midnight library stays, well, at midnight. Because while it stays at midnight, your life, your root life, is somewhere between life and death. If time moves here, that means something very... She searched for a delicate word. Decisive has happened. Something that raises the midnight library to the ground and takes us with it. And so I would err on the side of caution. I would try to think very keenly about where you want to be. You have clearly made some progress, I can tell. You seem to realize that life could be worth living, if only you found the right one to exist inside. But you don't want that gate to close before you get the chance to go through it. They both were silent for a very long time, as Nora observed all the books all around her. All the possibilities. Calmly and slowly, she walked along the aisle, wondering what lay beyond the covers of each book, and wishing the green spines would offer some kind of a clue. Now, which book do you fancy? came Mrs. Elm's words behind her. Nora remembered Hugo's words in the kitchen. Dream big. The librarian had a penetrating gaze. Who is Nora Seed? And what does she want? When Nora thought of her closest access to happiness, it was music. Yes, she still played the piano and keyboard sometimes, but she had given up creating. She had given up singing. She thought of those happy early pub gigs playing Beautiful Sky. She thought of her brother larking about on stage with her and Ravi and Ella. So now she knew precisely which book to ask for. Fame. She was sweating. That was the first observation. Her body was coursing with adrenaline and her clothes were clinging to her. There were people around her, a couple of whom had guitars. She could hear noise. Vast, powerful human noise. A roar of life slowly finding rhythm and shape. Becoming a chant. There was a woman in front of her toweling her face. Thanks, Nora said, smiling. The woman looked startled, as if she'd just been spoken to by a god. She recognized a man holding drumsticks. It was Ravi. His hair was dyed white blonde, and he was dressed in a sharp-cut indigo suit with a bare chest where his shirt should have been. He looked an entirely different person to the one who had been looking at the music magazines and the newsagents in Bedford only yesterday. Or the corporate-looking guy in the blue shirt who had sat watching her do her catastrophic talk in the Intercontinental Hotel. Ravi, she said. You look amazing. What? He hadn't heard her over the noise, but now she had a different question. Where is Joe? She asked, almost as a shout. Ravi looked momentarily confused, or scared, and Nora braced herself for some terrible truth. But none came. The usual, I reckon, schmoozing it up with the foreign press. Nora had no idea what was going on. He seemed to be still part of the band, but also not in the band enough to be performing on the stage with them. And if he wasn't in the band, then whatever had caused him to leave the band hadn't caused him to disappear completely. From what Ravi said, and the way he said it, Joe was still very much part of the team. Ella wasn't there, though. On bass was a large, muscly man with a shaved head and tattoos. She wanted to know more, but now was clearly not the time. Ravi swept his hand through the air, gesturing towards what Nora could now see was a very large stage. She was overwhelmed. She didn't know what to feel. Encore time, said Ravi. Nora tried to think. It had been a long time since she had performed anything. And even then it was only in front of about 12 uninterested people in a pub basement. Ravi leaned in. You okay, Nora? It seemed a bit brittle. The way he had said her name seemed to contain the same kind of resentment she'd heard when she'd bumped into him yesterday, in that very different life. Yes, she said, full shouting now. Of course, it's just... I have no idea what we should do for the encore. Ravi shrugged. Same as always. Yeah, right. Nora tried to think. She looked out at the stage. She saw a giant video screen with the words, The Labyrinths, flashing and rotating out to the roaring crowd. Wow, she thought. We're big. Proper. Stadium level big. She saw a keyboard in the stool she had been sitting at. Her bandmates, whose names she didn't know, were about to walk back on stage. Where are we again? She asked above the crowd noise. I've gone blank. The big shaven-headed guy holding the bass told her, Sao Paulo. We're in Brazil. They looked at her as if she was mad. Where have you been the last 4 days? Beautiful sky, said Nora, realizing she could probably still remember most of the words. Let's do that. Again. Ravi laughed, his face shining with sweat. We did it 10 minutes ago. Okay, listen, said Nora, her voice now a shout over the crowd demanding an encore. I was thinking we'd do something different. Mix it up. I wonder if we could do a different song to usual. We have to do Howl, said the other band member, a turquoise lead guitar strapped around her. We always do Howl. Nora had never heard of Howl in her life. Yeah, I know, she bluffed. But let's mix it up. Let's do something they aren't expecting. Let's surprise them. You're overthinking this, Nora, said Ravi. I have no other type of thinking available. Ravi shrugged. So what should we do? Nora struggled to think. She thought of Ash, with his Simon and Garfunkel guitar songbook. Let's do Bridge Over Troubled Water. Ravi was incredulous. What? I think we should do that. It will surprise people. I love that song, said the female bandmate. And I know it. Everyone knows it, Imani, Ravi said dismissively. Exactly, Nora said, trying her hardest to sound like a rock star. Let's do it. Milky Way. Nora walked onto the stage. At first, she couldn't see the faces because the lights were pointing towards her. And beyond that glare, everything seemed like darkness. Except for a mesmerizing Milky Way of camera flashes and phone torches. She could hear them, though. Human beings, when there's enough of them together acting in total unison, become something else. The collective roar made her think of another kind of animal entirely. It was at first kind of threatening. As if she was Hercules facing the many-headed Hydra who wanted to kill him. But this was a roar of total support. And the power of it gave her a kind of strength. She realized, in that moment, that she was capable of a lot more than she had known. Wild and free. She reached the keyboard, sat down on the stool and brought the microphone a little closer. Thank you, Sao Paulo, she said. We love you. And Brazil roared back. This, it seemed, was power. The power of fame. Like those pop icons she had seen on social media, who could say a single word and get a million likes and shares. Total fame was when you reach the point where looking like a hero or genius or god required minimal effort. But the flip side was that it was precarious. It could be equally easy to fall and look like a devil or a villain. Or just an ass. Her heart raced, as if she were about to set foot on a tightrope. She could see some of the faces in the crowd now, thousands of them emerging from the dark. Tiny and strange, the clothed bodies almost invisible. She was staring out at 20,000 disembodied heads. Her mouth was dry. She could hardly speak, so wondered how she was going to sing. She remembered Dan mock wincing as she'd sung for him. The noise of the crowd subsided. It was time. Right, she said. Here is a song you might have heard before. This was a stupid thing to say, she realized. They had all paid tickets for this concert, presumably because they had heard a lot of these songs before. It's a song that means a lot to me and my brother. Already the place was erupting. They screamed and roared and clapped and chanted. The response was phenomenal. She felt, momentarily, like Cleopatra. An utterly terrified Cleopatra. Adjusting her hands into position for E-flat major, she was momentarily distracted by a tattoo on her weirdly hairless forearm, written in beautifully angled calligraphic letters. It was a quote from Henry David Thoreau. All good things are wild and free. She closed her eyes and vowed not to open them until she had finished the song. She understood why Chopin had liked playing in the dark so much. It was so much easier that way. Wild, she thought to herself. Free. As she sang, she felt alive. Even more alive than she had felt swimming in her Olympic champion body. She wondered why she had been so scared of this. Of singing to a crowd. It was a great feeling. Ravi came over to her at the end of the song while they were still on stage. That was fucking special, man, he shouted in her ear. Oh, good, she said. Now let's kill this and do Howl. She shook her head, then spoke into the microphone hurriedly before anyone else had a chance to. Thank you for coming, everybody. I really hope you all had a nice evening. Get home safely. Get home safely, Ravi said in the coach on the way back to the hotel. She hadn't remembered him being such an arse. He seemed unhappy. What was wrong with that? She wondered out loud. Hardly your normal style, wasn't it? Well, bit of a contrast to Chicago. Why, what did I do in Chicago? Ravi laughed. Have you been lobotomized? She looked at her phone. In this life, she had the latest model. A message from Izzy. It was the same message she'd had in her life with Dan, in the pub. Not a message at all, but a photo of a whale. Actually, it might have been a slightly different photo of a whale. That was interesting. Why was she still friends with Izzy in this life and not in her root life? After all, she was pretty sure she wasn't married to Dan in this life. She checked her hand and was relieved to see a totally naked ring finger. Nora supposed it was because she had already been super famous with the Labyrinths before Izzy decided to go to Australia. So Nora's decision not to go may have been more understandable. Or maybe Izzy just liked the idea of a famous friend. Izzy wrote something under the picture of the whale. All good things are wild and free. She must have known about the tattoo. Another message came through now from her. Hope Brazil was a blast. I'm sure you rocked it. And thanks 10 million for sorting the ticks out for Brisbane. I'm totally stoked, as we Gold Coasters say. There were a few emojis of whales and hearts and thanking hands and a microphone and some musical notes. Nora checked her Instagram. In this life, she had 11.3 million followers. And bloody hell, she looked amazing. Her naturally black hair had a kind of white stripe in it, vampiric makeup, and a lip piercing. She did look tired, but she supposed that was just a result of living on tour. It was a glamorous kind of tired, like Billie Eilish's cool aunt. She took a selfie and saw that while she didn't look exactly like the excessively styled and filtered photos on her feed, which had been for magazine shoots, she did look cooler than she ever imagined she could look. As with her Australian life, she also put poems up online. The difference with this life, though, was that each poem had about 500,000 likes. One of the poems was even called Fire, but it was different to the other one. She had a fire inside her. She wondered if the fire was to warm her or destroy her. Then she realized a fire had no motive. Only she could have that. The power was hers. A woman sat next to her. This woman wasn't in the band, but she exuded importance. She was about 50 years old. Maybe she was the manager. Maybe she worked for the record company. She had the air of a strict mum about her, but she began with a smile. "Stroke of genius," she said. "The Simon and Garfunkel thing, you're trending across South America." "Cool. I've posted about it from your accounts." She'd said this like it was a perfectly normal thing. "All right. Okay. There's a couple of last-minute press things tonight at the hotel, and tomorrow is an early start. We fly to Rio first thing, then 8 hours of press all at the hotel." "Rio? You're up to speed with the week's tour schedule, right?"
Kind of. Could you just remind me again?"
She sighed with good humor, as if Nora not knowing the tour schedule was totally in character.
"Sure. Rio tomorrow, 2 nights, then the final night in Brazil, Porto Alegre, then Santiago, Chile, Buenos Aires, then Lima, and that's the last leg of South America. Then next week it's the start of the Asia leg, Japan, Hong Kong, the Philippines, Taiwan."
"Peru? We're famous in Peru."
"Nora, you've been to Peru before, remember? Last year. They went out of their minds, all 15,000 of them. It's at the same place, the race course."
"The race course? Sure. Yeah, I remember. It was a good night. Really good."
That's what this life probably felt like, she realized. One big race course. But she had no idea if she was the horse or the jockey in that analogy.
Ravi tapped the woman on the shoulder. "Joanna, what time's that podcast tomorrow?"
"Oh, damn. Actually, it's tonight now. Timing, sorry. Forgot to say. But they really only have to speak to Nora, so you can get an early night if you want."
Ravi shrugged, dejected.
"Sure, yeah."
Joanna sighed. "Don't shoot the messenger. That's never stopped you before."
Nora wondered again where her brother was, but the tension between Joanna and Ravi made it feel wrong to ask something she should so obviously know. So she stared out of the window as the coach drove along the four-lane highway. The glowing taillights of cars and lorries and motorbikes in the dark, like red and watching eyes. Distant skyscrapers with a few tiny squares of light against a humid backdrop of dark sky and darker clouds. A shadowy army of trees lined the sides and middle of the highway, splitting the traffic into two directions. If she was still in this life tomorrow evening, she would be expected to perform an entire concert's worth of songs, most of which she didn't actually know. She wondered how quickly she could learn the set list. Her phone rang, a video call. The caller was Ryan. Joanna saw the name and smirked a little.
"You'd better get that."
So she did, even though she had no idea who this Ryan was, and the image on the screen seemed too blurry to recognize. But then he was there, a face she had seen in movies and imaginings many times.
"Hey, babe. Just checking in with a friend. We're still friends, right?"
She knew the voice, too. American. Rugged. Charming. Famous. She heard Joanna whispering to someone else on the coach. "She's on the phone to Ryan Bailey." Ryan Bailey. Ryan Bailey. As in the Ryan Bailey. As in the Ryan Bailey of her fantasies, where they talked about Plato and Heidegger through a veil of steam in his West Hollywood hot tub.
"Nora, you there? You look scared."
Yeah. I'm here on a bus, a big touring, yeah. Hi.
"Guess where I am."
She had no idea what to say. Hot tub seemed entirely inappropriate as an answer.
"I honestly don't know."
He panned the phone around a vast and opulent-looking villa, complete with bright furnishings and terracotta tiles, and a four-poster double bed veiled in a mosquito net. Nayarit, México, he pronounced Mexico in a parody of Spanish, with the X as an H. He looked and sounded slightly different to the Ryan Bailey in the movies. A bit puffier. A bit more slurred. Drunker, perhaps? On location. They got me shooting Saloon 2. Last Chance Saloon 2. Oh, I so want to see the first one. He laughed as if she had told the most hilarious joke. Still dry as ever, no-no. No-no. Staying at the Casa de Mita, he went on. Remember the weekend we had there? They put me in the exact same villa. You remember? I'm having a mezcal margarita in your honor. Where are you?
Brazil. We were just doing a concert in Sao Paulo.
Wow. Same landmass. That's cool. Yeah, cool.
It was really good, she said.
You're sounding very formal.
Nora was aware half the bus was listening in. Ravi was staring at her as he drank a bottle of beer.
I'm just, you know, on the bus. There are people around.
People, he sighed, as if it was a swear word. There are always people. That's the fucking problem. But hey, I've been thinking a lot recently about what you said on Jimmy Fallon.
Nora tried to act as if every sentence he said wasn't an animal running into the road.
What did I say? You know, about how it just ran its course. Me and you. How there were no hard feelings. I just want to thank you for saying that. Because I know I am a difficult fucking person. I know that. But I'm getting work for that. The therapist I'm seeing is really fucking good.
That's great.
I miss you, Nora. We had great times. But there is more to life than fantastic sex.
Yes, said Nora, trying to keep her imagination in check. Absolutely.
We had all kinds of great, but you were right to finish it. You did the right thing in the cosmic order of things. There is no rejection. There is only redirection. You know, I've been thinking a lot about the cosmos. I've been tuning in, and the cosmos has been telling me I need to get my shit together. It's balance, man. What we had was too intense, and our lives are too intense, and it's like Darwin's third law of motion about an action leading to a reaction. Something had to give, and you were the one who saw that, and now we are just particles floating in the universe that may reconnect one day at the Chateau Marmont.
She had no idea what to say.
I think that was Newton.
What?
The third law of motion.
He tilted his head like a confused dog.
What?
Never mind. It doesn't matter. He sighed.
Anyway, I'm going to finish this margarita because I got an early training session. Mezcal, you see, not tequila. Gotta keep pure. Got this new trainer, this MMA guy. He's intense.
Okay.
And no-no.
Yeah?
Can you just call me your special name for me again?
You know the one.
Obviously. Yeah, of course.
She tried to think what it could be.
Rye-rye? Rye bread? Plato? I can't.
People.
She made a show of looking around.
Exactly, people. And you know, now that we've moved on with our lives, it seems a bit inappropriate.
He smiled a melancholy smile.
Listen,
I'll be there for the final LA show. Front row, Staples Center. You won't be able to stop me. Got it?
That's so sweet.
Friends forever.
Friends forever.
Sensing they were nearing the end of the conversation, Nora suddenly had something to ask.
Were you really into philosophy?
He burped. It was strange how shocking it was to realize that Ryan Bailey was a human being in a human body that generated gas.
What?
Philosophy. Years ago, when you were playing Plato in The Athenians, you gave an interview and you said you read a lot of philosophy.
I read life, and life is a philosophy.
Nora had no idea what he meant, but deep down she was proud of this other version of her for dumping an A-list movie star. I think at the time you said you read Martin Heidegger.
Who is Martin Hot Dog?
Oh, it was probably just press bullshit, you know. You say all sorts of shit.
Yeah, of course.
Adios, amiga.
Adios, Ryan.
And then he was gone, and Joanna was smiling at her, saying nothing. There was something teacherly and comforting about Joanna. She imagined that this version of herself liked Joanna. But then she remembered she was supposed to do a podcast on behalf of a band where she didn't know the names of 50% of its members, or the title of their last album, or any of their albums. The coach pulled up at a grand-looking hotel outside of town. Fancy cars with darkened windows. Palm trees wrapped in fairy lights. Architecture from another planet.
A former palace, Joanna told her. Designed by a top Brazilian architect. I forget his name.
She looked it up.
Oscar Niemeyer, she said after a moment. Modernist, but this is meant to be more opulent than his usual stuff. Best hotel in Brazil.
And then Nora saw a small crowd of people holding out their phones with outstretched arms, as if beggars with bowls, filming her arrival. You can have everything and feel nothing. At Nora Labyrinth. 74,800 retweets. 485,300 likes. A silver tray of honey cakes. It was wild to think of this life coexisting with her others in the multiverse, just like another note in a chord. Nora found it almost impossible to believe that while in one life she was struggling to pay the rent, in another she was causing such excitement among people all over the world. The handful of fans who had filmed the tour bus arrive at the hotel were now waiting for autographs. They didn't seem too bothered about the other band members, but they did seem desperate to interact with Nora. She looked at one as she crunched over the gravel towards them. The girl had tattoos and was wearing an outfit that made her look like a flapper girl who had somehow got caught up in a cyberpunk version of a post-apocalyptic war. Her hair was styled exactly like Nora's, complete with matching white stripe.
Nora! Nora! Hi! We love you, Queen! Thank you for coming to Brazil! You rock!
Then another chant started.
Nora! Nora! Nora!
While she was signing autographs in an illegible scribble, a man in his early 20s took off his t-shirt and asked her to sign his shoulder.
It's for a tattoo, he said.
Really?
She asked, writing her name onto the man's body.
This is the highlight of my life, he gushed. My name is Francisco.
Nora wondered how her writing on his skin with a Sharpie could be a highlight of his existence.
You saved my life. Beautiful sky saved my life. That song, it's so powerful.
Oh, wow. Beautiful sky. You know beautiful sky. The fan burst into hysterics.
You're so funny.
This is why you are my idol. I love you so much. Do I know, beautiful sky? That's brilliant.
Nora didn't know what to say. That little song she had written when she was 19 years old at university in Bristol had changed the life of a person in Brazil. It was overwhelming. This, clearly, was the life she was destined for. She doubted that she would ever have to go back to the library. She could cope with being adored. It was better than being in Bedford, sitting on the number 77 bus, humming sad tunes to the window. She posed for selfies. One young woman looked close to tears. She had a large photo of Nora kissing Ryan Bailey.
I was so sad when you broke up with him.
I know. Yeah, it was sad. But you know, things happen. It's a learning curve. Joanna appeared at her arm and gently guided her away towards the hotel. When she reached the elegant jasmine-scented lobby, marble, chandeliers, floral displays, she saw that the rest of the band were already in the bar. But where was her brother? Maybe he'd been schmoozing the press somewhere else. As she started to move towards the bar, she realized that everyone, concierge, receptionists, guests, was looking at her. Nora was about to finally seize the opportunity to ask about her brother's whereabouts when Joanna beckoned over a man who was wearing a t-shirt with The Labyrinth printed on it in a retro sci-fi movie font. The guy was probably in his 40s, with a graying beard and thinning hair, but he seemed intimidated by Nora's presence. He did a tiny bow when he shook Nora's hand.
"I'm Marcello," he said. "Thank you for agreeing to the interview."
Nora noticed another man behind Marcello, younger, with piercings, tattoos and a big smile, holding recording equipment.
"We'd reserved a quiet space in the bar," Joanna said, "but there's people. I think we'd better do this in Nora's suite."
"Great," said Marcello. "Great, great."
As they walked over to the lift, Nora glanced back at the bar and saw the other band members.
"You know, maybe you'd like to speak to the others too," she said to Marcello.
"They remember things I don't. A lot of things."
Marcello smiled and shook his head and delicately said,
"It works better this way, I feel."
"Oh, okay," she said.
Every eye was on them as they waited for the lift to arrive. Joanna leaned into Nora.
"Are you okay?"
"Of course, yeah, why?"
"I don't know, it's just, you seem different tonight."
"Different how?"
"Just different."
As they got in the lift, Joanna asked another woman, one Nora recognized from the coach, to bring some drinks from the bar. Two beers for the podcasters, a sparkling mineral water for Nora, and a caipirinha for herself.
"And bring them up to the suite, Maya."
"Maybe I'm teetotal in this life," thought Nora, as she walked out of the lift and along the plush salmon pink carpet to her suite. And then, as she entered it, she tried to act like this was all perfectly normal. This gigantic room, leading to another gigantic room, leading to a gigantic bathroom. There was a vast bouquet of flowers for her with a note signed by the hotel's manager.
"Wow,"
she resisted saying, as she gazed around at the lavish furnishings, the sweeping floor-to-ceiling curtains, the pristine white bed the size of an acre, the TV the size of a small cinema, the champagne on ice, the silver tray full of Brazilian honey cakes, as the card informed them.
"Don't suppose you'll be having any of these," said Joanna, taking one of the little delicacies from the tray. "Now that you're on that new plan, Harley said I had to keep an eye on you."
Nora watched Joanna bite into one of the cakes and wondered how good any plan could be if it didn't involve eating something so clearly delicious as a Brazilian honey cake. She had no idea who Harley was, but she knew she didn't like them.
Also, just so you know, the fires are still going on in LA and they're evacuating half of Calabasas now, but hopefully it won't get as high as your place.
Nora didn't know whether to be pleased at the idea of having a house in LA or worried that it was about to go on fire. The two Brazilian podcast guys took a few moments to set up their equipment, and Nora sunk herself into the vast sofa in the living area as Joanna, attending to a few rogue crumbs around her mouth with a heavily manicured finger, explained that their music podcast, O Som, was the most popular in Brazil.
Great demographics, Joanna enthused, and the numbers are stratospheric. It's totally worth doing. And she stayed there, watching like a hawk mother as the podcast began. The Podcast of Revelations.
So, it has been a crazy year for you, Marcello began, in his very good English.
Oh, yeah, it has been quite a ride, said Nora, trying to sound like a rock star.
And now, if I may ask about the album, Pottersville, you wrote all the lyrics, yes?
Mostly, yes, Nora guessed, staring at the small familiar mole on her left hand.
She wrote all of them, interjected Joanna.
Marcello nodded while the other guy, still smiling toothily, fiddled about with sound levels via a laptop.
I think Feathers is my favorite track, said Marcello as the drinks arrived.
I'm glad you like it.
Nora tried to think of a way she could get out of this interview. A headache? A bad stomach?
But the one I'd like to talk about first is the first one you decided to release. Stay Out of My Life. It seemed like such a personal statement.
Nora forced a smile.
The lyrics say it all, really. Obviously, there has been some speculation about whether it refers to the, how do you say it in English?
Restraining order? Offered Joanna helpfully.
Yes, the restraining order. Said Nora, taken aback.
Well, I prefer to get it all out in the song. I find that stuff difficult to talk about.
Yes, I understand. It's just that in your recent Rolling Stone interview, you talked a little about your former boyfriend, Dan Lord, and mentioned how difficult it was to get the restraining order against him after he stalked you. Didn't he try and break into your house? Then tell reporters that he wrote the lyrics for Beautiful Sky?
Jesus.
She hovered at the intersection of tears and laughter, and managed somehow to give neither.
I wrote it when I was still with him. But he didn't like it. He didn't like me being in the band. He hated it. He hated my brother. He hated Ravi. He hated Ella, who was one of the original members. Anyway, Dan was very jealous.
This was so surreal.
In one life, the life he'd supposedly wanted, Dan was so bored in his marriage to Nora he was having an affair, while in this life he was breaking into her house because he couldn't stand her success.
He's a dick, said Nora.
I don't know the Portuguese swear word for a terrible person.
Cabral. It means someone's a dick.
Or an asshole. The younger guy added, stone-faced.
Yeah, well, he's a Cabral. He turned out to be someone else entirely.
It's weird, the way when your life changes, people act in different ways.
The price of fame, I suppose.
And you wrote a song called Henry David Thoreau. You don't get many songs named after philosophers.
I know, well, when I studied philosophy at university, he was my favorite. Hence my tattoo. And it made a marginally better song title than Immanuel Kant.
She was getting into the swing of it now. It wasn't too hard to act a life when it was the one she was destined for.
And Howl, obviously, such a powerful song. Number one in 22 countries, Grammy award-winning video with a Hollywood A-list cast. I suppose you were done talking about it.
I suppose, yes.
Joanna went to get herself another honey cake. Marcello smiled gently as he pressed on.
For me, it seemed so primal.
The song, I mean, like you were letting everything out. And then I discovered you wrote it on the very night you fired your last manager. Before Joanna. After you found out he'd been ripping you off.
Yeah, that wasn't good, she improvised. It was such a betrayal.
I was a big Labyrinth fan before Howl, but that was the one for me. That and Lighthouse Girl. Howl was where I was like, Nora Seed is a genius. The lyrics are pretty abstract, but the way you just let out that rage was so soft and soulful and powerful all at once. It's like early Cure fused with Frank Ocean via The Carpenters and Tame Impala. Nora tried and failed to imagine what that could possibly sound like. He started to sing, to everyone's surprise. Silence the music to improve the tune, stop the fake smiles and howl at the moon. Nora smiled and nodded as if she knew these lyrics.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was just howling. Marcello's face became serious. He seemed genuinely concerned for her. You've had so much shit to deal with these last few years. Stalkers, bad managers, the fake feuds, the court case, the copyright issues, the messy breakup with Ryan Bailey, the reception of the last album, rehab, that incident in Toronto, that time you collapsed from exhaustion in Paris, personal tragedy, drama, 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 and all that media intrusion. Why do you think the press hate you so much? Nora began to feel a bit queasy. Was this what fame was like? Like a permanent bittersweet cocktail of worship and assault? It was no wonder so many famous people went off the rails when the rails veered in every direction. It was like being slapped and kissed at the same time. I don't know, it's pretty crackers. I mean, do you ever wonder what your life would have been like if you had decided to take a different path? Nora listened to this as she stared at the bubbles rising in her mineral water. I think it's easy to imagine there are easier paths, she said, realizing something for the first time. But maybe there are no easy paths. There are just paths. In one life, I might be married. In another, I might be working in a shop. I might have said yes to this cute guy who asked me out for a coffee. In another, I might be researching glaciers in the Arctic Circle. In another, I might be an Olympic swimming champion. Who knows? Every second of every day, we are entering a new universe. And we spend so much time wishing our lives were different. Comparing ourselves to other people and to other versions of ourselves, when really most lives contain degrees of good and degrees of bad. Marcello and Joanna and the other Brazilian guy were staring at her wide-eyed. But she was on a roll now, freewheeling. There are patterns to life. Rhythms. It is so easy, while trapped in just the one life, to imagine that times of sadness or tragedy or failure or fear are a result of that particular existence. That is a byproduct of living a certain way, rather than simply living. I mean, it would have made things a lot easier if we understood there was no way of living that can immunize you against sadness. And that sadness is intrinsically part of the fabric of happiness. You can't have one without the other. Of course, they come in different degrees and quantities. But there is no life where you can be in a state of sheer happiness forever. And imagining there is just breeds more unhappiness in the life you're in. That is a great answer, Marcello said after he was sure she was finished. But tonight I would say, at the concert, you seemed happy. When you played Bridge Over Troubled Water instead of Howl, that was such a powerful statement. It was saying, I am strong. It felt like you were telling us, your fans, that you were okay. And so how is touring going?
Well, it's great.
And yes, I just thought I'd send a message that, you know, I am out here living my best life. But I miss home after a while.
Which one?
asked Marcello with a quietly cheeky smile. I mean, do you feel more at home in London or L.A. or on the Amalfi Coast? It seemed this was the life where her carbon footprint was the highest. I don't know. I suppose I would say London. Marcello took a sharp intake of breath, as if the next question was something he had to swim under. He scratched his beard. Okay. But I suppose it must be hard for you, as I know you shared that flat with your brother. Why would it be hard? Joanna gave her a curious glance from above her cocktail. Marcello looked at her with sentimental fondness. His eyes seemed glazed. I mean, he went on after a delicate sip of beer. Your brother was such a big part of your life, such a big part of the band. Was. So much dread in such a small word. Like a stone falling through water. She remembered asking Ravi about her brother before the encore. She remembered the crowd's reaction when she had mentioned her brother on stage. He's still around. He was here tonight. She means she feels him, said Joanna. They all feel him. He was such a strong spirit. Troubled, but strong. It was a tragedy how the drink and the drugs